From Sydney to Paris, campus protests against the war in Gaza ramp up outside the U.S. While Israel and Hamas negotiate a ceasefire agreement. I'm Marco Werman. Today we look at obstacles and best-case scenarios for a truce. Also, a city in Thailand used to welcome people fleeing Myanmar. Now there's a crackdown on undocumented residents.
There's a lot of corruption that's fueling it. A lot of the Burmese people will joke here that they're like human ATMs for the Thais.
And many countries are pushing for a treaty to control plastic, but some petroleum-producing holdouts like Russia and Saudi Arabia...
They do not want reduction of production of plastics.
Plus, new details about the life and death of Plato, pulled from the ashes of Mount Vesuvius. That's all ahead today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for making it this Tuesday. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says there will be a ground invasion into Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip. It will happen, he says, whether there's a ceasefire deal with Hamas or not. This is something Netanyahu has talked about for weeks, but those comments seem to fly in the face of reports that ceasefire negotiations between Israel and Hamas could be making progress. On Monday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the Israelis have presented an extraordinarily generous offer for a truce and that the only thing standing between the people of Gaza and a ceasefire is Hamas.
The Israelis have put a strong proposal on the table. They've demonstrated that they're willing to compromise. And now it's on Hamas. And no more delays, no more excuses. The time to act is now.
Blinken plans to be in Israel tomorrow, where he's expected to push Netanyahu's government to work toward ending the war. But as The World's Matthew Bell reports, there are plenty of pressures pulling the Israeli prime minister in the opposite direction.
One of the most hardline voices in Israeli politics is that of Itamar Ben-Gvir. He's the far-right minister of national security. Ben-Gvir said he met with the Israeli prime minister today, and he told Netanyahu that ending the war in Gaza is not acceptable, because that would mean Israel loses. Another far-right minister in Netanyahu's coalition, Bezalel Smotrich, today appeared to threaten to quit the government if the prime minister makes a deal to free the hostages. He said a ceasefire now would be like, quote, waving the white flag and granting victory to Hamas, unquote. But a negotiated deal is exactly what might be in the works.
It seems we are the closest we were since this war began, with the exception of the previous prisoner exchange.
Ehud Eran is a political scientist at the University of Haifa. He says the indirect negotiations between Israel and Hamas involving various other powers are happening behind closed doors, but there have been signs of progress.
Sources of optimism are reports that elements in the Israeli government are willing to go ahead, reports that Netanyahu is willing to give things he was unwilling to do before, leaks from the mediators. And I think also in the Israeli public, there's a bit of early signs of being tired of the conflict as it is now.
Khalid Al-Gindi at the Middle East Institute in Washington says the Israelis appear to have softened a couple of demands.
One is allowing people who have been evacuated to southern Gaza to return to their homes or whatever may be left of their homes and neighborhoods in north Gaza. Up until now, Israel has been very keen to not allow any significant number to return.
And two, Al-Gindi says, is some new language around these negotiations about sustainable calm.
And that is sort of a nod to one of Hamas's principal demands and really, you know, what the protest movement is demanding, what most people around the world are demanding, and that is a permanent ceasefire.
Speaking in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, yesterday, British Foreign Secretary David Cameron said the deal being discussed now is for a sustained 40-day ceasefire and that thousands of Palestinian prisoners could be set free in exchange for remaining Israeli hostages in Gaza. Khalid Al-Gindi says it remains to be seen if Hamas will agree to that, because Israel has arrested and imprisoned thousands of Palestinian so-called security prisoners in recent months, mostly in the West Bank. The Israelis could release those detainees in a Gaza deal, but
they can and very often do immediately or shortly thereafter rearrest them. or re-detain them. So it's unclear how useful that is, but it's important symbolically for Palestinians because the prisoner issue is one that has touched almost every Palestinian family.
There's been speculation about the possibility of persuading the leaders of Hamas in Gaza to leave the territory. That would be in exchange for an end to the Israeli military's months-long campaign. But Tariq Masood of Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government says that's probably not likely.
I just don't see Hamas doing that. Hamas has never evinced a high degree of sensitivity to civilian casualties. And so while I do think Hamas would want to see this war come to an end, they would probably not accept any condition that had them leaving the Gaza Strip.
Masood says what Hamas probably wants at this point is to be able to declare some kind of victory.
I think they want to be able to say that they withstood Netanyahu's assault on the territory, that they struck a blow against Israeli occupation, what they see as Israeli abuses of the Palestinian rights. So they'd like to be able to say they won.
The Biden administration has talked about an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and a hostage exchange as a step towards something much bigger, and that's the revival of the long-stalled peace process aimed at getting to a two-state solution. Since October 7th last year, Secretary of State Antony Blinken has met with officials from Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar. But those governments have seemed hesitant to offer anything like robust support for the administration's post-war plans. In the meantime, Netanyahu is also under pressure at home to find a way to get those hostages back. Massive protests in Israel continue, and members of his government coalition are also warning the prime minister against sinking a ceasefire deal that could finally save the lives of those still being held in Gaza. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
In Haiti, gang violence continues to rule most of the capital, Port-au-Prince, but amid the mayhem, a step towards stability. A new prime minister has assumed the office that's been effectively vacant for 2 months. Today, former sports minister Fritz Belizaire stepped into the role. Belizaire was chosen by the transitional council that was sworn in last week precisely to select a new prime minister and cabinet. Belizaire had the support of 4 of the 7 voting members. The former prime minister, Ariel Henry, only recently officially resigned his post. He had not returned to Haiti since a trip he made in March to Kenya, where he'd been pushing for Nairobi to send a police force to Haiti as part of an international effort to reestablish order. Let's turn now to the ongoing conflict in Myanmar. Generals took power in a coup just over 2 years ago, overthrowing Aung San Suu Kyi's elected civilian government. Since then, ethnic rebel groups have been fighting back against the military government, and they have made significant gains. Earlier this month, soldiers from the Karen rebel group briefly controlled the town of Myawadi. That's a critical trading town along the Burmese-Thai border in southeastern Myanmar. Throughout the conflict, Burmese people have fled Myanmar to Mae Sot, a border town in Thailand. But as more Burmese people have fled to Mae Sot, the more Thai police have cracked down on those refugees, making their lives miserable. Reporter Naomi Gingold is in Mae Sot, Thailand, and observing what's happening there. I asked her to first give us some context to the fighting in Myanmar.
Following the military coup, there was this like huge protest movement that sprang up, and like everyone from doctors to bureaucrats at government ministries to truck drivers went on strike, and there were these peaceful protests that the military started attacking. And over time, I watched friends and colleagues go from protesting to learning how to make weapons. So, you know, the deposed democratic lawmakers started this civilian government, and there's been this armed resistance that sprang up kind of under the civilian government that's been working now with all these ethnic armies that are like ringing the country that have been fighting the military for decades. And there's even been urban resistance movements, right? That was where we saw, you know, we saw Zaya Thaw, the hip hop star, about a year and a half ago, executed for his role in leading the first urban resistance in Yangon.
Mm. So in Mae Sot, Naomi, what do the expats and refugees coming from Myanmar, what do they want, both generally, and what do they want from Thailand?
I mean, from Myanmar, in a nutshell, they want federal democracy. Here in Thailand and in Mae Sot, they want to not be so harassed. I mean, like, it's pretty bad. Every night, the Thai police pretty much goes around just kind of randomly stopping cars. And if somebody can't, like, show a passport, show a legal visa, they will get arrested. In fact, I was almost arrested on Friday night with two undocumented Burmese journalists who were in the car with me.
Yeah, talk more about this crackdown by the Thai government in Maesat on the Myanmar refugees there. I mean, why is it happening, and why is it happening now?
I mean, I think, so two reasons, I would say, primarily. One, the Thai government wants to show that it's, you know, a partner with the junta, that they have this relatively cozy relationship with. And then I think also, you know, Thailand doesn't want to appear lenient so that they don't encourage more people to flee. But at the same time, people are fleeing because they're getting bombed, or they're fleeing because they're getting arrested and tortured, or will be.
Yeah, so it sounds like a fragile haven for refugees from Myanmar.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's like they're an integral part of the fabric of this town, but also constantly getting hit up by police for bribes to keep themselves out of jail. I have a friend of a friend who hasn't left his apartment in months because he's afraid of getting arrested again. And I know another contact here who just eats dry goods, is afraid to go to the grocery store and get actual, like, produce and proper food because it's so close to one of the checkpoints.
So prior to this crackdown by the Thai government, Maesat was a haven?
So Maesat has been a haven for a while, for, like, the ethnic minorities that have been fleeing. But for, you know, it's only since the coup that we've been seeing this kind of whole other class, I would say, of more, like, educated Burmese, especially from the cities who are here in Maesat.
Of all the places along that long border between Myanmar and Thailand, Naomi, why is Maesat so important? Why does it have this concentration of refugees?
So, there's over $1 billion worth of trade that goes over the bridge here from Maesat into Myanmar. So, I mean, it's a pretty strategic place. And were the resistance forces to fully capture Miawadi on the other side, it would be a really big deal. And they've already made serious gains.
Yeah, so for the refugees now in Maesat, I mean, where do they go next? That must be a question they're all thinking about.
Oh, this is, like, in many ways, the million-dollar question. I mean, a lot of the refugees in Maesat, immigration has just stopped. Or I should say it was halted. For example, the United States had stopped taking refugees from Myanmar for quite a long time. Recently, that's kind of started to move again. But so a lot of people have been stuck here for a very, very long time without really a way out. A lot of people are looking to get resettled, but there are just so many people here that I think their existence remains tenuous here in Thailand.
Reporter Naomi Gingol spoke with us from Maesat, Thailand, on the circumstances facing refugees arriving there from Myanmar. Stay with The World This Week for more reporting on the war in Myanmar and the gains that rebel groups have made as they fight back against the military junta. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. For nearly 40 years, the State Department's au pair program has brought young people to the U.S. to provide child care to families in exchange for room, board, and about $200 a week in pocket money. It's billed as a cultural program, but many say it exploits au pairs. The State Department is considering an overhaul to the program's rules with an eye on hourly wages. Massachusetts already made similar changes at the state level. As GBH reporter Hannah Reale in Boston reports, the changes could upend a visa program that means different things to different people.
A work program for foreign live-in nannies?
Having the sort of big sister type in the house.
100% this is a cultural exchange program.
It seemed like a good solution for childcare with our schedules.
That last speaker was Krista Kitchen, who has three young kids. She's an emergency room doctor, and so is her husband.
In terms of life events or shifts that we need to cover for work last minute, it's still been like a godsend for us.
22-year-old Wendy Perez came from Ecuador to care for the Northampton family's kids. She lives with them and gets paid minimum wage, with a room and board deduction each week. For Perez, she joined the program to work on her English.
It's a great opportunity to learn a new language, improve your language.
More than 20,000 young foreign nationals work in the U.S. as au pairs every year. They get visas with the help of a small number of agencies that also do the work of matching families with au pairs for a fee of about $10,000. But the State Department put out a sweeping proposal late last year that would change how the program works. After a quarter century of au pairs being paid less than $200 a week, it could switch to an hourly wage, what Massachusetts already did in 2020. Here's Mike DeMauro, who leads Agent Au Pair, one of those agencies.
Massachusetts was one of the largest states of participation of the au pair program. Obviously, pretty affluent part of the country. 70% of the families left the program.
Just under 1,500 au pairs worked in Massachusetts a few years ago. Today, it's less than a third of that. That's a major statistic being used to push back against the proposal. And host parent Jamie Rowan has witnessed the change in real time.
When my first au pair came, there were at least 20, I think, au pairs in the area. There are no au pairs left in Amherst, Massachusetts, except for my au pair.
Costs more than doubled basically overnight for many families. That pay comes on top of food and other expenses like providing car access and insurance. DeMauro says a lot of families in states with higher minimum wages would leave.
And literally 90% of the families plus are saying if these regulations are implemented as is, they will leave the program.
Lita Matthew is a co-director at the Matahari Women Workers Center, which advocated for the state law that got au pairs up to minimum wage. She's sympathetic to families who could be thinking,
what the heck are we going to do about childcare, you know? The au pair program, I think, is a band-aid for a system that is clearly not working. And I think we're just going to need more than holding down the labor rights and the wages of au pairs to solve that problem.
What comes next is a waiting game. Since public comment closed, the State Department could put out a final regulation at any time. But for Kitchen and her family, she says they'll try to stick it out as long as they can.
I think we're in the program for as long as it's around for us.
For The World, I'm Hannah Rialli.
So those are decisions that American families are making about whether the au pair program still makes sense for them financially. We wanted to learn what it's like for the au pairs themselves, usually young women who come to the U.S. to live with families and watch after their kids. Karina Yoselin Perez is an au pair from Mexico. She works for a family in New York City. We caught her on an afternoon off from work to learn what her experience has been like.
So I like to spend time with kids, and also, you know, I'm from Mexico, and I thought it was a good opportunity for me to travel to another country, learn more about the culture, you know, food, meet people from all over the world, and of course, learn English better. So yeah.
And the family you're working for in New York City, tell us a bit about them. How many kids? How old are they?
So I take care of a girl. She's 3, almost 4. The boy is 9 years old, so usually I just get them ready for school in the mornings, and then I pick them up from school, then we spend some time at home, or if the weather's nice, we go to the park, then have dinner, you know, then showers, and get ready for bed.
So you're spending a lot of the day with them. I mean, it sounds like you're their primary caretaker.
Yeah, it's 8 hours on weekdays, and yeah, one day of the weekend, so it's 45 hours a week. That's the maximum. But overall, I've had a lot of opportunities to meet other people, to travel. I have even traveled with them, and I've met a lot of friends. So very nice.
So let's get to this money question. Tell me about your current benefits. You've got room, board, and about $200 a week in pocket money. Has that been enough to live on?
Well, I would say yes, because, you know, we don't have to pay or an apartment, we don't need to pay for food or utilities. Sometimes even they provide a phone because, you know, we use it for work. But yeah, I mean, we just need to budget a lot because 200, you know, we still need to, we want to travel, we want to, you know, like toiletries and stuff. So yeah, it's hard sometimes, but if you know how to budget, it can be possible to do something.
Yeah, I mean, I heard a little hesitation in your voice. You also want to save some money as well. You've no doubt heard, Karina, about the proposed changes to the au pair program. that would require families to pay the state's minimum wage. Au pairs would also get worker protections as part of it. What do you see as the pros and cons of an idea like that?
Honestly, when I started reading, I got a little excited because, you know, I work full time and I heard they would change to part-time au pairs and full-time. So, of course, I could be a full-time and it could be paid more. And I'm like, yeah, you know, if it's full-time and if I can get paid more, you know, you also enjoy more your job and everything. And also some au pairs are not needed that many hours. So they get paid the normal amount. So I think that's fair. And also one of the changes was that we would have more money to study. So that's also a very good opportunity for us. The cons, I think there could be less families interested in the program because, you know, it could be more expensive and then they would compare to having a babysitter or just nanny. So yeah, that leaves less spots for new au pairs coming, I think.
I mean, there are people who say this program is unfair to au pairs, that they are taken advantage of when there's no minimum wage and these benefits. What kind of conversations have you had with other au pairs about that?
Yeah, you know, honestly, being here, you hear a lot of experiences. Some girls have had very good experiences. They travel a lot with them. They are treated as part of the family, which is great. But others are just exploded. They just work a lot and the family doesn't care about them. And so there's a lot, you know, some good and bad experiences.
Karina Yoselin Perez is an au pair from Mexico looking after two kids in New York City. The State Department is now considering rule changes for how au pairs are compensated. You're listening to The World. In India's mega election, Prime Minister Narendra Modi is counting on women to show up at the polls. This voter is sold. She credits Modi with delivering gender equality, jobs for women, and opportunities in sports. But not every woman is buying what Modi is selling. That story still ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Protests against the war in Gaza at universities around the U.S. show no signs of slowing or de-escalating. Outside the United States, campus demonstrations are gaining momentum. In Montreal today, McGill University requested police assistance to clear a protest encampment. At the University of Sydney in Australia, students have set up a temporary encampment modeled on the one at Columbia University in New York. These are not the only examples of students around the globe apparently following the lead of U.S. students. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports from Sydney.
About 200 students marched through Central Campus in the rain, chanting Free Palestine and Columbia First, You Sit Next. That's short for University of Sydney. All universities must divest.
All universities must divest.
At the end of the protest, demonstrators rushed into the road, blocking traffic. And then they march back to the encampment in the main quadrangle. It's been a week since the tents popped up, inspired by the encampments at Columbia University and other campuses in the U.S. Declan Godwin is one of the organizers.
It's safe to say without the U.S., there wouldn't be an encampment here. And it was a very simple case of us watching the videos of students occupying their universities and then of police smashing those occupations up, which inspired us to think, well, why don't we just do the same thing here?
Students across the globe appear to have had the same idea. In Paris this week, police removed dozens of protesters who had occupied the main courtyard of the Sorbonne University. At Sciences Po University, which is also in Paris, students blocked access to a campus building with makeshift barricades made from bicycles, plastic trash bins, and planks of wood. Demonstrators at University College London demanded an end to the war in Gaza.
We're obviously very keen to show our solidarity and our support for American protesters. But one thing these American protests are very clear on, and we're clear on too, is the center of this movement isn't London or New York or any other city, it is Gaza, it is Palestine.
In Italy, violent clashes broke out with police at Rome's La Sapienza University. Students there chained themselves together and went on a 3-day hunger strike. And protest encampments are going up at universities in Canada and New Zealand. Here at the University of Sydney, protesters say they have no plans to leave anytime soon. There are about 60 or so tents clustered in front of the Gothic Great Hall. Some are spray-painted with the controversial slogan, "From the River to the Sea," and "Disclose, Divest." Here is organizer Declan Godwin.
We're demanding the university cut its ties with Israel through the strategic research partnerships that the university has with weapons companies such as Thales, which is the 6th largest weapons company in the world.
Thales funds PhD programs at the University of Sydney in the mechanical and electrical engineering departments. Thales also works with Israeli weapons manufacturer Elbit Systems to build drones that have been used in attacks on Gaza.
Our university allows student and staff research to go towards perfecting that military technology, sometimes without the knowledge of the staff and students who are participating.
The University of Sydney has indicated it won't divest from firms that do business with Israel or boycott academic exchanges with Israeli universities. The university declined a request to comment, but sent a statement saying the school is committed to allowing peaceful protests, but warned anyone breaking the university's rules would face disciplinary action. So far, the university protests in Sydney and other countries overseas have remained relatively calm, but students here say what they're doing is still significant. Jasmine El Rawi represents Students for Palestine.
I was sent a photo that was taken in Gaza where someone had written on one of their tents in one of the many, kind of refugee camps that are being set up. They wrote Australia, we see you and we hear you in Gaza. So what we're doing isn't just a small thing here at Sydney University, but actually gives them hope as well. Yeah.
El Rawi says she wants people in Gaza to know that students around the world are standing with them and watching what's happening on campuses across the U.S. She's eager to see that message spread. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum, Sydney.
In ancient news, the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in 79 AD, just south of Naples, Italy, preserved countless treasures. The latest is actually the discovery of what is written on an ancient papyrus scroll and offers a new account of the Greek philosopher Plato's final night on Earth. Scholars have finally managed to decipher the document. We reached out to Stanford Plato scholar Christopher Babonich to learn more.
We learned that he died at a wedding, perhaps in the presence of a slave girl who was playing music. The story goes that she wasn't a very good performer, and he was indicating to her the measure of the music when he died. This would be a perfect way for Plato to die, since he was fascinated by mathematics and thought mathematics was the key to understanding the universe.
Yes, so let me get this straight. Plato is essentially on his deathbed. He's being serenaded on a flute by this slave girl, and he takes the time to criticize her playing?
Yes. Like she's not getting the measure right. And he was deeply interested in the mathematical structure of music. All these scrolls were discovered in a small anteroom. This was a luxurious villa, and it had a reading room, and that contained furniture. Think of the, old Brit country houses with their ornate libraries. These scrolls that we're finding are tucked away in this small closet. And one plausible suggestion is that the person who had the library wasn't really deeply interested in them. And also that in some of the other scrolls that he was more interested in would have been taken away before the villa was buried. And since he didn't care that much about these, and he left them behind, and that's why we have them.
Yeah, and these scrolls were discovered some years ago. Are you saying they were in this closet, and the closet was filled with volcanic ash?
Yep. And the villa was excavated, it was first found in around early 1700s, and then about the mid-1700s, they found these scrolls. And these scrolls were carbonized, and the lava flowed over them. And the scroll has a wooden spindle, and the papyrus is wrapped around it. So they're just large black clumps. And they were doing the excavation in the winter. The workmen were cold. They looked and said, great, charcoal. Throw them in the fire. So we lost a number that way.
Oh, no.
They destroyed some of them in reading them early on because they're stuck together. You couldn't peel it off in one go. So they would have to destroy the top layer to get down further into the scroll. And lamentably, they hired cheap labor. They hired local workmen who didn't read Greek. So before destroying the lettering, they would draw the letters that they saw, but they would just draw shapes.
I mean, that really explains why it took so long to decode the contents of these scrolls. How exactly were researchers able to kind of see the writing on them?
At first, you just hold up in the sunlight and you peer at it. And then they started using microscopes. And they started using much more advanced techniques to bring up hidden lettering. They've done that with a number of different things in the past 20 years, and they've uncovered some really fascinating things.
For some of the scrolls that got burned, Christopher, you must wonder what could have been on them.
Yes. I mean, we've lost so much from antiquity. For Plato, we're very fortunate, and we have over 100% of everything he wrote. But we have only a fraction of Euripides, Aeschylus, Sophocles, Aristotle, all lost.
Christopher, you spent decades thinking about Plato's work. What is it about his story that you find relevant today?
I mean, it seems that he was right in thinking that the fundamental truths about the physical universe are describable in mathematical terms. Aristotle did not think that, and he thought we could give a qualitative description, and he wasn't keen on a quantitative description that Plato had. The other really interesting thing about Plato and the thing that is relevant today is that he thinks that if you hold your ethical beliefs unreflectively, and even if you have true beliefs about what's good, bad, right, wrong, and so on, this is a serious moral defect. It's a moral failing.
Christopher Babunich is a professor of philosophy at Stanford. He's been telling us about new discoveries that shed light on the final hours of the Greek philosopher Plato. The Chinese scientist who was the first to publish the COVID-19 virus sequence has been locked out of his lab in Shanghai. Zhang Yongzhen has staged a sit-in protest outside the lab since authorities over the weekend prevented his team from entering, as he described in an online post. This is part of a pattern of harassment against the virologist, which began when he published the COVID-19 sequence without official approval in 2020. "I won't leave. I won't quit. I am pursuing science and the truth," he wrote in a post on the Chinese social media platform Weibo. The post was later deleted. In a statement, Shanghai Public Health Clinical Center, which housed Zhang's lab, said it was closed for renovations and that alternative space has been provided. Zhang denied that this offer had actually been extended. The move is further proof of the Chinese authorities' efforts to control messaging and information around the COVID-19 virus since the outbreak, punishing all those who have gone against those efforts. The election underway in India is not just big, it is a mega election, with voting continuing through the month of May. Prime Minister Narendra Modi is hoping to win a historic third term. Last week at a rally, he was accused of stoking anti-Muslim sentiment. He said that when the opposition party was in power, they would take people's wealth and give it to Muslims who have more children. He asked the crowd, "Do you think your hard-earned money should be given to infiltrators?" Critics called it hate speech and asked the Election Commission to intervene. Meanwhile, more women are participating in this election than ever before. They're expected to account for nearly half of the electorate. Great news in theory, but it shrouds a more complicated reality. Sushmita Pathak reports from the conservative state of Rajasthan in western India.
In a small house at the end of a narrow alley in the city of Jodhpur, women are hard at work. They're sewing little scraps of cloth together to make a patchwork. This is a vocational training center run by a local nonprofit. Women from low-income families come here to learn self-defense and skills like sewing or embroidery. 31-year-old Yasmin Bano guides a square piece of cloth under the needle. She tells me she's never missed voting in an election. But that wasn't the case for her mother or grandmother.
इन सब चीजों में पहले जेंट्स लोग ही वो इतना इंटरेस्ट लेते थे महिलाएं नहीं
बैक इन द डे ओनली मेन यूज्ड टू टेक एन इंटरेस्ट इन वोटिंग इन इलेक्शंस वुमेन वर मोर कंसर्न्ड विद हाउस वर्क शी सेज बानो इज पार्ट ऑफ इंडियाज इमर्जिंग फीमेल वोटर ब्लॉक By 2029, women voters are expected to outnumber men. And politicians are taking note.
The Congress party announcing another guarantee ahead of elections.
Political parties have been courting women voters. Their promises cover everything from cash transfers to public toilets and hostels for women. But one party has been particularly successful in appealing to women. Prime Minister Narendra Modi's party, the BJP. At another training center in Jodhpur, women tell me they're rooting for Modi. Modi has tried to bring gender equality, says Pooja Prajapati. He has created jobs for women, created opportunities for women in sports, she says. Sitting beside her, Priyanka Barasa rattles off a string of welfare schemes introduced by Modi. Under the programs, low-income families have received subsidized cooking gas, water and electricity connections, affordable housing, and more. But many of these schemes cast women primarily as caregivers. Take this BJP campaign ad, for example.
माँ हम सबको मजबूत बनाती है, लेकिन माँ को मजबूत कौन बनाता है?
Mothers give us strength, and Modi gives strength to mothers, the ad goes. Political scientist Ritika Kumar says there's a patriarchal connotation in the way political parties talk about women's issues.
More needs to be done to think of women's identities beyond the household.
Doing so is important because Indian women's participation in the workforce is abysmally low, says Kumar. Many women I met in Jodhpur said they wanted to work but were discouraged by their families or were tied down by responsibilities at home.
So it's a very interesting contrast that we're seeing that women are actually coming out to vote, but it doesn't seem to be translating in some of the other key dimensions of female empowerment.
Kumar says significant gender gaps still remain in other forms of political engagement. For example, women make up only 14% of India's lower house of parliament.
Even things like, you know, attending campaign rallies or like door-to-door canvassing, all of these still remain very, very male-dominated spaces.
And while more women are turning up to vote, their choice is often decided by the men in their family, says Govind Singh Rathore. He's the founder of Sambhali Trust, the non-profit that runs the vocational training centers in Jodhpur. Many of the women his nonprofit serves don't have much exposure to the news or social media, he says.
Unfortunately, since it's patriarchy, they're not strengthened enough to taking such sort of decisions on their own.
It all boils down to the deeply ingrained conservative culture in states like Rajasthan, he says. The gender divide here is very wide.
In our Western Rajasthan, boy child's favorable. So when you do not have a boy child, so what you do is you cut hair short from the girl children and start calling them with derogatory terms or names so that, you know, God would then bless you with a boy child.
He's seen parents name their daughters Dhapu, which roughly translates to being fed up. This misogynistic attitude needs to change, Rathore says. At the training center in Jodhpur, I ask women about their hopes for the future. They say they want more focus on women's education, more jobs, better safety, and more freedom. You can't post a photo, you can't wear shorts, you can't wear makeup or speak out because society will judge you, says Rita Khichi. Another woman, Chanchal Chauhan, says she never used to dance because she lacked confidence. But not anymore. Every Saturday, the women take a break from their work and turn the music up. Now I dance my heart out, Chauhan says. For the world, I'm Sushmita Pathak in Jodhpur, Western India.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The UN is trying to come up with a treaty to end plastic pollution. At a meeting that concluded in Ottawa yesterday, they got one step closer, but there is still a long way to go. That's because plastics are everywhere, and there is deep disagreement among nations about the right course of action. Recycle and reuse, or phase out plastics altogether. Christian Saber is a professor at Roskilde University in Denmark who studies plastic pollution and is just outside Ottawa, where he earlier attended the UN talks on behalf of the Scientist Coalition for an Effective Plastics Treaty. That's a group of 350 scientists from around the globe who want to ensure that the treaty is based on science. I asked him what was achieved at the Ottawa meeting.
I think the most important thing that was achieved was that the treaty negotiations moves on, right? So this is the fourth out of five negotiation rounds. The treaty is supposed to be finalized by November in South Korea. Some of the steps towards adopting such a treaty is agreeing on the treaty text, but there's also all the technical aspects that have to support the specific treaty text. And that is what's called intersessional work, so working groups of works in between the sessions here. And the three negotiation rounds leading up to this one, none of them gave a mandate for this type of intersessional work. But at this one, there was finally an agreement within two areas: financial mechanism, how is this going to be financed globally, and then also on chemicals of concern in plastic products and recycling and reuse of plastic products. And then there was also adopted a legal drafting group that is going to work more explicitly on the text that's supposed to go into the treaty. So that was the big wins of Ottawa.
Without getting too technical, break down what the primary disagreement is among nations.
The absolutely fundamental disagreement is whether we need to reduce plastic production and consumption or whether it's a matter of handling waste in a better way. And there is two coalitions, you can say. On one hand, you have what's called the High Ambition Coalition, which is primarily African and European countries, but also other places. They want an ambitious treaty that reduces plastic pollution as much as possible, and that requires reduction of consumption and production of plastics. Then on the other side, there is a like-minded coalition with Russia, Saudi Arabia, India, and China leading that. And they do not want reduction of production of plastics. They say this is a waste problem. We can handle that by better waste management. We don't have to reduce how much we actually consume.
You know, for years, and this goes back to when I was a kid, we've heard about the benefits of recycling. Are some of these countries like Russia and India, are they arguing that recycling is still a solution?
Yes, this is exactly what has been said. And this is also what we have heard from the producing industry for many, many years, that recycling is the way forward. And the reason why they are very fond of that is that if we can recycle ourselves out of this problem, we don't have to change our current consumption pattern. So the economy can move on as it is now. The problem is that that doesn't work. And we have invested a lot of money in trying to make recycling work. Actually, it's 88% of all the money that's been invested into sort of solutions to plastic have gone into recycling solutions. And only 4% has gone into what's called reuse solution. And even though we have invested so much, we only have a 9% recycling rate on a global scale today, according to the OECD.
9%?
9%. So despite we have sort of invested everything into that type of solution. So it's not a solution. It won't work. From a scientific point of view, there is no evidence that this is going to work in the foreseeable future.
What are the arguments many other countries are making against recycling?
It's not against recycling as such, but the thing is there's just a lot of other steps that have to come first. We have to reduce consumption. So plastic is a fantastic material in many ways, but we also overconsume it in many ways where it's not needed. So there's a lot of plastic products that we should get rid of, like plastic cups, cutlery, all these type of single-use plastic products. They consume an extreme amount of materials, and we don't really need them. So we should get rid of those. And then for those plastics that we need to make them in a better quality so they last longer. And then when we have something that has been produced well, so let's take a plastic cup that can last for 10 years if it's a really good plastic cup, but in the end it breaks or it doesn't work anymore, and then it has to be recycled. So that's why we still need recycling, but we need it after a lot of other good solutions. And currently we are going to recycling first, and that's not going to bring us anywhere near the target we want to go to.
What are the specific hazards of plastic pollution? Remind us, for plants, for humans, other animals?
We can put them into two different categories. So the first one would be what we would call physical impact. I think most people have seen pictures of a turtle that has been entangled in a fishing net, for example. That's a physical impact. But it also something like birds eating plastic, which they cannot digest, so it fills up their stomach and they starve to death. But also even if we go down to the smallest plastic particles, maybe most people have heard about microplastics, but we can also go down to even smaller sizes called nanoplastics. They are so small, so we cannot see them with our eyes. but they are so small so they can be taken up across biological barriers. So there are studies that shows that these nanoplastic particles can be taken up across the brain barrier in mice. So that means that we get them into the brain. And there is just a lot of studies that show this type of effect can have severe consequences for diseases like Alzheimer's, also some microplastic has been linked to increase heart stroke rate, these kind of things. So there's an array of different effects from these, what we call the physical effects. And then there is the chemicals. There's a lot, maybe more than 4,000 chemicals that are used in plastics. And these have effects like carcinogenic effects. They are endocrine disruptors, really severe effect that impact human health. So there's the physical impact of the plastics, and then there's sort of what we call the chemical impact of the chemicals that are added to the plastics.
Yeah, and plastic production and use is only increasing worldwide. It seems a lot of these data points are very specific, like nanoplastics are now at the top of Mount Everest. It's been discovered, just one headline, for example. What are some of the ways we can comprehensively measure the pervasiveness of plastic?
Yeah, that's tricky, right? And some of the things there are also working to establishing different kind of monitoring programs. These are typically either national or regional. So there are monitoring programs for example, microplastics in surface water in the European Union. That could be one thing. But one of the challenges that we face from a scientific point of view is that the smallest particles, so the nanoplastic particles, we don't have the technologies yet to measure them in, for example, something like tissue from animals or for humans. So we don't really know where they are in nature. Those that we work with are typically ones we produce and control in experimental settings, but we don't really have the good technology to measure these smallest particles in nature yet.
Christian Seber is a professor at Roskilde University in Denmark who studies plastic pollution. The next round of talks on a potential plastics treaty are expected this November in South Korea. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening. Join us right back here tomorrow.